I could have lost my life. Over what? What was the purpose? He said as tears ran down his cheeks. We were just enjoying ourselves. We weren't out harming anyone. We were in our space, our community, our home, enjoying ourselves like everybody else does. Detectives were examining whether anyone had helped Aldrich before the attack, Police Chief Adrian Vasquez said. He said patrons who intervened during the attack were heroic and owed a debt of gratitude for preventing more deaths. Club Q is a gay and lesbian nightclub that features a drag show on Saturdays, according to its website. Club Q's Facebook page said planned entertainment included a, quote, punk and alternative show, close quote, preceding a birthday dance party with a Sunday all-ages drag brunch. Southers noted that the club had operated for 21 years and had not reported any threats before Saturday's attack. Drag events have become a focus of anti-LGBTQ rhetoric and protest recently, as opponents, including politicians, have proposed banning children from them, falsely claiming they're used to, quote, groom, close quote, children. Attorney General Merrick Garland was briefed on the shooting, and the FBI was assisting police with the investigation. To substantiate a hate crime charge against Aldrich, prosecutors would have to prove he was motivated by the victim's actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. So far, the suspect has not been cooperative in interviews with investigators and has not given them clear insight yet about the motivation for the attack, according to the official who spoke on condition of anonymity. President Joe Biden said that while the motive for the shootings was not yet clear, we know that the LGBTQI+ community has been subjected to horrific hate violence in recent years. Places that are supposed to be safe spaces of acceptance and celebration should never be turned into places of terror and violence, he said. We cannot and must not tolerate hate. Colorado Governor Jared Polis, who became the first openly gay man in the United States to be elected governor in 2018, called the shooting sickening. My heart breaks for the family and friends of those lost, injured, and traumatized, Polis said. Colorado stands with our LGBTQ community and everyone impacted by this tragedy, we mourn. A makeshift memorial sprang up Sunday near the club with flowers, a stuffed animal, and candles, and a sign saying, Love over Hate, next to the rainbow-colored heart. Seth Stang was buying flowers for the memorial when he was told that two of the dead were his friends. The 34-year-old transgender man said it was like having a bucket of hot water getting dumped on you. I'm just tired of running out of places where we can exist safely. Ryan Johnson, who lives near the club and was there last month, said it was one of only two night spots for the LGBTQ community in conservative-leaning Colorado Springs. It's kind of the go-to for pride, the 26-year-old said of the club, which is tucked behind other businesses, including a bowling alley and a sandwich shop. Colorado Springs, a city of about 480,000, located 70 miles south of Denver, is home to the U.S. Air Force Academy, the U.S. Olympic Training Center, as well as Focus on the Family, a prominent evangelical Christian ministry that lobbies against LGBTQ rights. The group condemned the shooting and said it exposes the evil and wickedness inside the human heart. In November 2015, three people were killed and eight wounded at a Planned Parenthood clinic in the city where authorities say a gunman targeted the clinic because it performed abortions. Club Q is devastated by the senseless attack on our community, the club posted on Facebook. We thank the quick reactions of heroic customers that subdued the gunman and ended this hate attack. The CEO of a national LGBTQ rights organization, Kevin Jennings of Lambda Legal, pleaded for tighter restrictions on guns. America's toxic mix of bigotry and absurdly easy access to firearms means that such events are all too common, and LGBTQ plus people, BIPOC communities, the Jewish community, and other vulnerable populations pay the price again and again for our political leadership's failure to act, he said in a statement. The shooting came during Transgender Awareness Week and just at the start of Sunday's International Transgender Day of Remembrance, when events around the world are held to mourn and remember transgender people lost to violence. In June, 31 members of the neo-Nazi group Patriot Front were arrested in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and charged with conspiracy to riot at a pride event. Experts warned that extremist groups could see anti-gay rhetoric as a call to action. The previous month, a fundamentalist Idaho pastor told his small Boise congregation that gay, lesbian, and transgender people should be executed by the government, which lined up with similar sermons from a Texas fundamentalist pastor. Since 2006, there have been 523 mass killings and 2,727 deaths as of November 19, according to the Associated Press USA Today database on mass killings in the U.S. Also on the front page, and on a lighter note, is an article entitled A Small Town Christmas. Lamar's will have a winter carnival, music, and 26-foot tree. The article is by Earl Horlick from the Sioux City Journal. There's holiday spirit around every corner in downtown Lamar's, as well as a 26-foot Christmas tree in the middle of Olson Event Center. If things seem a bit chaotic right now, that's okay, said Margaret Catton. Somehow, our Christmas in hometown Lamar's festival always comes together, she said. Catton, a Lamar's business owner, ought to know. She's been one of the event's volunteers since its inception 3 years ago. With a full slate of family-friendly activities, Christmas in hometown Lamar's will kick off the holiday season in the Plymouth County town on Saturday. The festival was inspired by a 2019 holiday trip that Habitué Coffeehouse owner Cheryl Wells took to New York City. She wanted to bring the excitement, joy, and grandeur of a Big Apple Christmas to the ice cream capital of the world. Wells, along with her husband Mike Wells, CEO of Wells Enterprises, Michaela Brown of the gospel singing group, The Browns, and volunteers like Catton, started Christmas in hometown Lamar's as a mostly virtual event during the COVID year of 2020. Despite that less than ideal start, the festival has grown in scope ever since. This year's event will kick off with a drive-in movie showing of 1994's The Santa Claus at 7 p.m. Friday at Total Motors, 801 Hawkeye Avenue, Southwest. The real fun begins at 8:30 a.m. Saturday when Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer makes a stop for breakfast at the Central Event Center, 10 Central Avenue South. Immediately after that, Santa and Mrs. Claus will set up shop at Habitué Coffeehouse, 108 Central Avenue Northeast, while Kids Craft food vendors and a scavenger hunt become situated in various spots throughout Lamar's downtown district at 9 a.m. Sportier people may enjoy a Santa 5K, 10K fun run, which will start at the Olson Event Center, 33 First Street Northeast, at 10 a.m. This is always fun because we ask runners to dress in Christmas attire, Catton said. Plus, there are several new events for this year. They include pony rides and a petting zoo outside of the Wells Visitor Center and Ice Cream Parlor, 115 Central Avenue Northwest, a safety with s'mores activity conducted by the Lamar's Fire Department, and even a Christmas carnival with a magic show, balloon stations, face painting, and temporary tattoos. Entertainment will include a 1 p.m. concert with Sioux City-based singer Jill Miller. At 1:30 p.m., the Browns will host their Home for Christmas show at Century Theater, 11 Central Avenue Northwest. Dancers from the CDA dance troupe and the Turnaround Studio ballet students will perform at 2 p.m. and 3 p.m. respectively. This will all lead up to the 6 p.m. lighting ceremonies of the 26-foot-tall Christmas in Hometown Lamar's Christmas tree at the Olson Event Center, which will be followed with a concert from the Browns. With dashing store displays and an entire day full of free family activities, people can experience what makes the ice cream capital of the world a must-see holiday destination, Catton said. Also on the front page is an article entitled Council to Vote on Development Agreement for $24 million Multifamily Subdivision. The article is by Dolly Butts. The Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to approve a development agreement with a local businessman for a $24 million multifamily subdivision on the city's east side. Dan Heiserot of the Ridge SC, LLC plans to build a new 212-unit multifamily residential subdivision at the Eagle Ridge Addition, 3800 Glen Ellen Road. Over the last year, city staff has been working with Heiserot. The development property contains roughly 14 acres and is currently vacant. The Planning and Zoning Commission and the City Council both approved the rezoning and final plat in May. The development costs are estimated at $24 million. The estimated value of the completed project is $22 million, according to city documents. The current assessed value of the vacant property is approximately $20,000. Under the terms of the development agreement, Heiserot agrees to apply for and receive all necessary permits, develop the property in accordance with the preliminary site plan so that 212 multifamily residential units can be constructed on the property prior to December 31, 2026, and execute a forgivable promissory note in the amount of $424,000. The city, in turn, agrees to pay $424,000 as an economic development grant to support the development, forgive the promissory note, and provide residential tax abatement on all eligible residential units completed before December 31, 2025. In May, the council green-lighted resolutions supporting the submission of tax credit applications to the Iowa Workforce Housing Tax Credit Program for the Glen Ellen Road project, as well as a multifamily development on the city's north side at 4205 Denise Court. The Denise Court development near Outer Drive will contain 48 market-rate residential units in its first phase. It is anticipated that future phases of the project will contain as many as 10 buildings and 120 units. The final article on the front page is entitled Action Urged After Report of High Court Leak. It's from the Associated Press. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee said his panel is reviewing serious allegations in a report that a former anti-abortion leader knew in advance the outcome of a 2014 Supreme Court case involving health care coverage of contraception. The report Saturday in the New York Times followed the stunning leak earlier this year of a draft opinion in the case in which the High Court overturned Roe v. Wade, ending constitutional protections for abortion. That decision was written by Justice Samuel Alito, who is also the author of the majority opinion in the 2014 case at the center of the new report. In the Times story, Reverend Rob Schenck, said he learned the outcome of the Burwell v. Hobby Lobby Stores case weeks before the decision was made public. In a 5-4 decision, Alito wrote that some companies with religious objections can avoid the contraceptives requirement in President Barack Obama's health care legislation. Schenck, who previously headed the group Faith and Action, has said in other recent stories in Politico and Rolling Stone that he was part of a concerted effort to forge social and ministry relationships with conservative justices. In the Times story, Schenck said the information about the Hobby Lobby decision came from Gail Wright, a donor to his organization, who was part of the outreach effort to the justices, and who had dined with Alito and his wife. Wright herself denied obtaining or sharing information in an interview with the Times. The New York Times also published a letter Schenck said he wrote Chief Justice John Roberts in July, alerting him to the alleged breach years ago. Schenck wrote that he thought the information might be relevant as part of a probe into the leak of the abortion decision. Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said in a statement Saturday that the committee is, quote, reviewing these serious allegations, close quote, and he called on fellow members of Congress to pass a bill that would require the High Court to adopt a code of ethics. Two fellow Democrats, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island and Representative Hank Johnson of Georgia, who chair courts subcommittees, issued a statement calling the Times report, quote, another black mark on the Supreme Court's increasingly marred ethical record, close quote, and said they, quote, intend to get to the bottom of these serious allegations, close quote. They, too, urged passage of a code of ethics. The Times story included an emphatic denial by Alito that he'd disclosed the outcome of the case. The court released Alito's full statement to the Associated Press. The statement read, the allegation that the Wrights were told the outcome of the decision in the Hobby Lobby case or the authorship of the opinion of the court by me or my wife is completely false. My wife and I became acquainted with the Wrights some years ago because of their strong support for the Supreme Court Historical Society, and since then we have had a casual and purely social relationship. I never detected any effort on the part of the Wrights to obtain confidential information or to influence anything that I did in either an official or private capacity, and I would have strongly objected if they had done so. I have no knowledge of any project that they allegedly undertook for Faith and Action, Faith and Liberty, or any similar group, and I would be shocked and offended if those allegations are true, it said. Schenck's Faith and Action group became Faith and Liberty after becoming part of the Liberty Council in 2018. Alito was appointed to the High Court in 2006 by President George W. Bush. On page 2 of the paper is an article entitled Gay Club Shooting Suspect Evaded Colorado's Red Flag Gun Law. It's by Bernard Condon and Colleen Sleben from the Associated Press. A year and a half before he was arrested in the Colorado Springs gay nightclub shooting that left 5 people dead, Anderson Lee Aldrich allegedly threatened his mother with a homemade bomb, forcing neighbors in surrounding homes to evacuate while the bomb squad and crisis negotiators talked him into surrendering. Yet despite that scare, there's no public record that prosecutors moved forward with felony kidnapping and menacing charges against Aldrich, or that police or relatives tried to trigger Colorado's red flag law that would have allowed authorities to seize the weapons and ammo the man's mother says he had with him. Gun control advocates say Aldrich's June 2021 threat is an example of a red flag law ignored, with potentially deadly consequences. While it's not clear the law could have prevented Saturday night's attack, such gun seizures can be in effect for as little as 14 days and be extended by a judge in 6-month increments. They say it could have at least slowed Aldrich and raised his profile with law enforcement. We need heroes beforehand, parents, co-workers, friends who are seeing someone go down this path, said Colorado State Representative Tom Sullivan, whose son was killed in the Aurora Theater shooting and sponsored the state's red flag law passed in 2019. This should have alerted them, put him on their radar. But the law that allows guns to be removed from people deemed dangerous to themselves or others has seldom been used in the state, particularly in El Paso County, home to Colorado Springs, where the 22-year-old Aldrich allegedly went into Club Q with a long gun at just before midnight and opened fire before he was subdued by patrons. An Associated Press analysis found Colorado has one of the lowest rates of red flag usage despite widespread gun ownership and several high-profile mass shootings. Courts issued 151 gun surrender orders from when the law took effect in April 2019 through 2021, 3 surrender orders for every 100,000 adults in the state. That's a third of the ratio of orders issued for the 19 states and District of Columbia with surrender laws on their books. El Paso County appears especially hostile to the law. It joined nearly 2,000 counties nationwide in declaring themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries that protect the constitutional right to bear arms, passing a 2019 resolution that says the red flag law, quote, infringes upon the inalienable rights of law-abiding citizens, close quote, by ordering police to, quote, forcibly enter premises and seize a citizen's property with no evidence of a crime, close quote. County Sheriff Bill Elder has said his office would wait for family members to ask a court for surrender orders and not petition for them on its own accord, unless there were exigent circumstances and probable cause of a crime. El Paso County, with a population of 730,000, had 13 temporary firearm removals through the end of last year, 4 of which turned into longer ones of at least 6 months. The county sheriff's office declined to answer what happened after Aldrich's arrest last year, including whether anyone asked to have his weapons removed. The press release issued by the sheriff's office at the time said no explosives were found, but did not mention anything about whether any weapons were recovered. Spokesperson Lieutenant Debbie Minot referred further questions about the case to the district attorney's office. An online court records search did not turn up any formal charges filed against Aldrich in last year's case. And in an update on a story on the bomb threat, the Gazette newspaper of Colorado Springs reported that prosecutors did not pursue any charges in the case and that records were sealed. The Gazette also reported Sunday that it got a call from Aldrich in August asking that it remove a story about the incident. There is absolutely nothing there. The case was dropped, and I'm asking you to either remove or update the story, Aldrich said in a voice message to an editor. The entire case was dismissed. A spokesperson for the district attorney's office, Howard Black, declined to comment on whether any charges were pursued. He said the shooting investigation will also include a study of the bomb threat. There will be no additional information released at this time, Black said. These are still investigative questions. AP study of 19 states and the District of Columbia with red flag laws on their books found they have been used about 15,000 times since 2020, less than 10 times for every 100,000 adults in each state. Experts call that woefully low and hardly enough to make a dent in gun killings. Just this year, authorities in Highland Park, Illinois, were criticized for not trying to take guns away from the 21-year-old accused of a 4th of July parade shooting that left 7 dead. Police had been alerted about him in 2019 after he threatened to kill everyone in his home. Duke University sociologist Jeffrey Swanson, an expert in red flag laws, said the Colorado Springs case could be yet another missed warning sign. "This seems like a no-brainer if the mom knew he had guns," he said. "If you removed firearms from the situation, you could have had a different ending to the story." House GOP pushes Hunter Biden probe despite thin majority. An article by Colleen Long from the Associated Press. Even with their threadbare House majority, Republicans are doubling down on using their new power next year to investigate the Biden administration and, in particular, the president's son. But the midterm results have emboldened a White House that has long prepared for this moment. Republicans secured much smaller margins than anticipated, and aides to President Joe Biden and other Democrats believe voters punished the GOP for its reliance on conspiracy theories and Donald Trump-fueled lies over the 2020 election. They see it as validation for the administration's playbook for the midterms and going forward to focus on legislative achievements and continue them, in contrast to Trump-aligned candidates whose complaints about the president's son played to their most loyal supporters and were too far in the weeds for the average American. The Democrats retained control of the Senate, and the GOP's margin in the House is expected to be the slimmest majority in two decades. "If you look back, we picked up seats in New York, New Jersey, California," said Mike Duhaime, a Republican strategist and public affairs executive. "These were not voters coming to the polls because they wanted Hunter Biden investigated. Far from it. They were coming to the polls because they were upset about inflation. They're upset about gas prices. They're upset about what's going on with the war in Ukraine." But House Republicans used their first news conference after clinching the majority to discuss presidential son Hunter Biden and the Justice Department, renewing the long-held grievances about what they claim is a politicized law enforcement agency and a bombshell corruption case overlooked by Democrats and the media. From their first press conference, these congressional Republicans made clear that they're going to do one thing in this new Congress, which is investigations, and they're doing this for political payback for Biden's efforts on an agenda that helps working people, said Kyle Herrig, the founder of the Congressional Integrity Project, a newly relaunched multi-million-dollar effort by Democratic strategists to counter the onslaught of House GOP probes. Inside the White House, the counsel's office added staff months ago and beefed up its communication efforts, and staff members have been deep into researching and preparing for the onslaught. They've worked to try to identify their own vulnerabilities and plan effective responses. But anything the House seeks related to Hunter Biden, who is not a White House staffer, will come from his attorneys who have declined to respond to the allegations. Representative James Comer, incoming chairman of the House Oversight Committee, said there are troubling questions of the utmost importance about Hunter Biden's business dealings and one of the president's brothers, James Biden, that require deeper investigation. He said they were examining the president, too. Rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government is the primary mission of the Oversight Committee, said Comer, a Republican from Kentucky. As such, this investigation is a top priority. Republican legislators promised a trove of new information this past week, but what they have presented so far has been a condensed review of a few years' worth of complaints about Hunter Biden's business dealings going back to conspiracy theories raised by Trump. Hunter Biden joined the board of the Ukrainian gas company Burisma in 2014, around the time his father, then vice president, was helping conduct the Obama administration's foreign policy with Ukraine. Senate Republicans have said the appointment may have posed a conflict of interest, but they did not present evidence that the hiring influenced U.S. policies, and they did not implicate Joe Biden in any wrongdoing. Republican lawmakers and their staff for the past year have been analyzing messages and financial transactions found on a laptop that belonged to Hunter Biden. They long have discussed issuing congressional subpoenas to foreign entities that did business with him, and they recently brought on James Mandolfo, a former federal prosecutor, to assist with the investigation as general counsel for the Oversight Committee. The difference now is that Republicans will have subpoena power to follow through. "The Republicans are going to go ahead," said Tom Davis, a Republican lawyer who specializes in congressional investigations and legislative strategy. "I think their members are enthusiastic about going after this stuff. There are a lot of unanswered questions. Look, the 40-year trend is parties under-investigate their own and over-investigate the other party. It didn't start here." White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre dismissed the GOP focus on the investigations as on-brand thinking. "They said they were going to fight inflation. They said they were going to make that a priority. Then they get the majority, and their top priority is actually not focusing on the American family, but focusing on the president's family," she said. Even some newly elected Republicans are pushing back against the idea. "The top priority is to deal with inflation and the cost of living. What I don't want to see is what we saw in the Trump administration, where Democrats went after the president and the administration incessantly," Representative-elect Mike Lawler of New York said on CNN. Hunter Biden's taxes and foreign business work are already under federal investigation, with a grand jury in Delaware hearing testimony in recent months. While he never held a position on the presidential campaign or in the White House, his membership on the board of the Ukrainian energy company and his efforts to strike deals in China have long raised questions about whether he traded on his father's public service, including reported references in his emails to the big guy. Joe Biden has said he's never spoken to his son about his foreign business, and nothing the Republicans have put forth suggests otherwise. And there are no indications that the federal investigation involves the president. Turning now to sports news, Harrington Cedar Catholic looks to knock off unbeaten Norfolk Catholic in Class C2 final. An article by Stu Pospisil from the World Herald. Harrington Cedar Catholic lost its final regular season game, fell to 6-3, and was one of the last five teams into the Class C2 playoffs. And now on to sports news. Harrington Cedar Catholic looks to knock off unbeaten Norfolk Catholic in Class C2 final. An article by Stu Pospisil from the World Herald. Harrington Cedar Catholic lost its final regular season game, fell to 6-3, and was one of the last five teams into the Class C2 playoffs. But the loss was to undefeated Norfolk Catholic, and 14-0 was the closest game of the season for the Knights. "It was a positive impact because it really let our kids know that we aren't that far off," Cedar coach Chad Catow said. "Playing the obvious number one, and deservedly so, team in the state, and they beat us by 14. It really made us feel like, hey, we're close. We just got to make a few more plays and just do a little more in our preparation." Three playoff wins later, one over a team that had been undefeated, Malcolm, 10-9 in overtime, another that reversed a regular season loss, Battle Creek, 6-0, Cato's Trojans, 9-3, have Cedar in the C2 title game for the first time since 2014. It's a rematch with number one, Norfolk Catholic, 12-0. Their game is 10:15 a.m. Tuesday at Memorial Stadium. Our kids have really stepped up the last 4 weeks on defense. They've played really well on that side of the ball, Cato said. Tackling has been probably the biggest thing that has been at a high level at this point. But Norfolk Catholic is a different animal than what we've seen in the last 3 weeks. We're going to really get challenged in that area. Both teams have endured attrition at running back, Cedar more so. Andrew Jones in the playoffs has moved from quarterback to running back. He's the sixth player to start there this season. We've had to move a lot of people around, Cato said. We moved Andrew and brought in Braden Riefenrath at quarterback. Andrew's a big physical runner. He's about 200 pounds. He definitely plays downhill. That's helped us a lot. We've gotten to play more ball control and special teams, trying to win field positions, and that's really helped us the last 2 weeks. Norfolk Catholic's leading rusher, Carter Kirkman, was shut down after several carries once the Knights took a 17-point lead in a 38-6 semifinal over Ord. He played sparingly in the previous game as well. He's had some issues with a bruised thigh, and we're trying to get through that, hoping it will be better, Norfolk Catholic coach Jeff Beller said. We then found some younger guys who can carry the ball for us. Senior fullback Kenyon Talton ran for 200 yards against Lincoln Lutheran and 162 against Ord. Trevin Sukup, Brandon Collars, and Nathan Timmerman also have gotten carries. Beller said Cedar's playoff run doesn't completely surprise him. When we played them, they were good up front, he said. It really was just a solid team we played. I don't know if they have any individuals that jump out and grab you, but I think they have a lot of good ones, and they really play well together. There should be no overconfidence from the Knights for the rematch. Our kids, when they came off the field, felt that it was a very physical contest, Beller said. We felt like we maybe left some things on the field, but I'm sure they did too. I think our kids understand that they'll have to be at their best, or they could be in trouble. That was very good for us in terms of how we're able to get the win, but had a very tough, hard-nosed game. And now a story about Red Raiders volleyball. Northwestern earns top seed in pool play for NAIA National Volleyball Tournament. Written by Tim Hines of the Sioux City Journal. Northwestern College earned a top seed Sunday for pool play in the NAIA National Volleyball Tournament in Sioux City. The Red Raiders, assigned to Pool H, will play number 3 seed Marion from Indiana on November 30 and number 2 seed Southwestern Assemblies of God University from Texas on December 2. Both matches will start at 4 p.m. on Court 2 at the Tyson Events Center. Number 8 ranked Northwestern, 22-7, advanced to the final site in Sioux City after downing Philander Smith College from Arkansas in a dominating 3 sets in an opening round match, 25-13, 25-6, and 25-13 in Orange City on Saturday night. SAGU, 33-0, won the Sooner Athletic Conference regular season title and tournament title with a 20-0 league mark. Of the 3 matches in the conference tournament, SAGU only dropped 1 set in the championship match against Texas Wesleyan. The Lions had a battle against Xavier University of Louisiana in the opening round on their home floor, winning in 5 sets, 25-19, 25-20, 18-25, 22-25, and 15-12. Marion earned a berth to pool play for the 5th straight season with a 4 sets victory over Park University Gilbert in Arizona, 25-20, 26-28, 25-19, 26-24. Marion are 24-6 in the regular season record and 13-5 in the Crossroads League,
defeating Huntington from Indiana in straight sets, and number 18-ranked Indiana Wesleyan in five sets, en route to the league championship match. The Knights fell to number 11 Taylor University, Indiana, in straight sets. Northwestern shook off a bit of a slow start in the opening set against Philander Smith Saturday, but it did not deter the final .513 final team hitting percentage. Philander Smith took the first 4 points out of the gate, and the Raiders did not see their first lead in the match until the 11-10 mark, thanks to a kill from Mackie Vanthool. The kill prior from Allison Dexter sparked what became an 8-0 Raider run that Northwestern used to put the set and eventually the match out of reach. The Raiders scored 8 of the last 9 points of the set, taking the set 25-13 behind a .448 team hitting percentage, the lowest set hitting percentage of the match for the Red Raiders. Dexter had recorded 7 of her 14 kills in the first set alone. Northwestern dominated the second set, jumping out to an 11-2 lead to force PSC to take a timeout. Following the timeout, the Panthers took back-to-back points, but a kill from Savon Sterk sparked yet another run, this time 10 straight points to take the commanding 22-4 lead. Northwestern prevailed in the set 25-6. Another massive run in the third set practically put the final nail in the coffin, as Becca Horseman Kill ignited the longest Raider run of the night in 11 straight points. Kiernan Groendijk rode the momentum on the serving line during that stretch. "I thought we passed service well, which allowed us to run at a fast tempo," head coach Kyle Vandenbosch said. "Our hitters got a lot of one-on-one situations, and they did a great job of attacking the court." The National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics announced pool play pairings Sunday for the national tournament site, which starts on November 30 at the Tyson. Northwestern is one of 5 GPAC schools that receive top seeds in pool play. The others include regular season champion Jamestown from North Dakota, Concordia from Nebraska, Midland from Nebraska, and Dakota Wesleyan from Nebraska. Top seeds also include 2-time defending champion Missouri Baptist from Corbin, Oregon, and Eastern Oregon. 24 teams will compete in 8 pools November 30 through December 2nd. Matches will be played at 10 a.m., 1 p.m., 4 p.m., and 7 p.m. At the end of pool play, the top team from each pool will advance to the single elimination bracket starting on Saturday, December 3. After a day of rest on Sunday, December 4, the semifinals will be played on Monday, December 5. The championship match on December 6 will be streamed on ESPN3. In South Dakota State volleyball news, Elk Point Jefferson places 3rd, Dakota Valley 5th in the South Dakota State volleyball tournament. Elk Point Jefferson finished in 3rd place and Dakota Valley placed 4th after winning consolation matches Saturday at the South Dakota Class A State volleyball tournament in Sioux Falls. In the 3rd place game, EPJ outlasted Miller in 4 sets, 18-25, 25-21, 25-21, and 25-22. The sophomore finished with 18 kills as EPJ won 25-21, 25-23, 23-25, and 27-25, avenging a 2-set loss to Wagner in the regular season and a 5-set heartbreaking loss to the Red Raiders in the Sweet 16 last season. Danica Torres led the Huskies' hitting attack with 12 kills, with Natalie Huretz close behind with 10. Setter Sophia Giorgio had 38 assists. Alyssa Chitka finished with 27 digs. EPJ, which finished the season 26-10, upset top-seeded Wagner in 4 sets in the quarterfinals Thursday before being swept by defending champion Sioux Falls Christian in the semifinals Friday, 17-25, 7-25, and 15-25. Sioux Falls Christian won its sixth straight state title Saturday night, defeating Elkton Lake Benton in four sets, 25-14, 25-20, 23-25, and 25-13. In the quarterfinals, Sioux Falls Christian swept Dakota Valley 25-14, 25-16, and 25-21. Dakota Valley battled back in the consolation bracket to finish in fifth place after outlasting Platte Geddes in five sets Saturday, 23-25, 25-17, 17-25, and 15-9. Sophie Tuttle led Dakota Valley's hitting attack Saturday with 21 kills, and Georgia Vandenhul added 15. Cameron Sommervold contributed 6 blocks. Senior setter Logan Miller recorded 47 assists. Katie Van Ruyen had a team-leading 35 digs. Carly Vanderwerf led Platte Geddes with 21 kills. Dakota Valley finishes the season 28-9. With another story about volleyball, Wildcats volleyball. Wayne State drops the NCAA Division II match against St. Cloud State. An article by the Journal staff. St. Cloud State won a marathon first set and used the momentum to build a two-set lead, then held off a Wayne State rally as the Huskies downed the number 2-ranked Wildcats 30-28, 25-16, 22-25, 25-22 in the semifinals of the NCAA Division II Central Region Volleyball Tournament in Wayne Saturday. Wayne State ends the season at 30-3, while number 7-ranked St. Cloud State took a 28-5 record into Sunday's 4 p.m. championship game against 3rd-ranked Concordia St. Paul, who defeated number 6 Minnesota Duluth 3-1 in the other semifinal Saturday evening at Rice Auditorium before a crowd of 1,054 fans. The grueling first set featured 16 ties and 5 lead changes between the two clubs. WSC held an 18-14 advantage, but the Huskies stormed back to force a 19-19 tie. SCSU had set point at 24-22, but WSC scored 3 straight points on a pair of Maggie Brammer kills and block by Brammer and Taylor Bunger to give the Cats set point at 25-24. The Cats also had 2 other set points, but with WSC leading 27-26, SCSU was able to come back and take the set 30-28. Brammer recorded 6 kills in the opening set, with Kelsey Cada adding 5. The Huskies produced 16 kills and just 1 error in the second set, never trailing, to take a 2-set lead with a 25-16 win. Taya Beller had 5 kills in the set for WSC. Wayne State got back into the match in the 3rd set, never trailing, to record a 25-22 win. WSC jumped out to a 10-6 lead. The Huskies got as close as 2 at 16-14, but the Cats pushed the lead back to 4 and finished with a 25-22 set victory. The Cats forced 9 SCSU attack errors in the set and saw Brammer and Cada each record 4 kills. The 4th set saw the Wildcats nearly rally from a 16-10 deficit, but the Huskies held back the WSC charge to end the season for Wayne State with a 25-22 win. Down 16-11, WSC got 3 straight blocks to cut the Husky lead to 16-14. The Cats got within 1 3 times, but the final one coming at 21-20 following Cada kill. St. Cloud State then scored the next 3 points for a 24-20 lead and won the set 25-22. St. Cloud State ended the match with a 294 hitting percentage compared to 270 for Wayne State. WSC held a 12-8 advantage in blocks but had one service ace compared to seven for the Huskies. Cada had 18 kills for Wayne State, followed by Taya Beller with 17 and Maggie Brammer 15. Taylor Bunger accounted for 8 blocks, with Beller adding 7. Setter Rachel Walker handed out 49 set assists, while senior libero Jesse Brandel notched 16 digs, with Jordan McCormick recording 13. Wayne State ends the season at 30-3, winners of the NSIC regular season title for the first time in school history. It's just the fourth time in school history that a Wildcat volleyball team has won 30 games in a season. Sunday was not a good day for the Vikings, as explained by Brian Hall in his column from the Associated Press, entitled "Vikings Offense Succumbs to Cowboys Pressure." Lined up on the edge on Minnesota's first pass play, Micah Parsons worked around Vikings left tackle Christian Darrisaw and pursued quarterback Kirk Cousins from his blind side. The Dallas Cowboys linebacker swatted the ball away from Cousins for a strip sack. It was the start of a long day for Cousins and the Vikings offense. Cousins was sacked a career-high 7 times for a loss of 49 yards. Minnesota had a season-low 183 total yards, and the Vikings were shocked at home 40-3 on Sunday. Kirk tried to battle tonight, Minnesota coach Kevin O'Connell said. It was a very tough night to play quarterback out there. We've got to do some things to help him anyway, shape or form. Coming off an emotional come-from-behind win at Buffalo a week earlier, the Vikings struggled from the outset, particularly against Parsons and the Cowboys' league-leading pass rush. Parsons said he saw a difference after his momentum-grabbing play on the first drive of the game. The ball was trying to come out quicker, Parsons said. Cousins was way more hesitant. Obviously, early pressure creates problems, and I thought he was coming out all night. I think we definitely caused a problem in their pass game, especially for where they was trending at. Minnesota's offensive line has been much improved this season, protecting Cousins well during an 8-1 start. Cousins was sacked 20 times in the first 9 games, putting the Vikings 10th in the league in sack percentage allowance entering the week. Darrisaw, who hadn't given up a sack all season, surrendered 2 before leaving for the second straight week with a concussion. At one point, Minnesota had backups in at left tackle and left guard. But Dallas mounted pressure all along the line, often with just 4 rushers, as Cousins and the Vikings were forced to drop back frequently with a big deficit. It's effective when you can rush 4, Cousins said. Certainly we want to be in a place where we're not having to drop back too much. You certainly need to be in a game where you're right there and you're not behind where you have to drop back. Dallas has a league-high 42 sacks this season. With 2 sacks Sunday, Parsons is second in the NFL with 10, 3 behind New England's Matt Judon. Up next for Minnesota is a Thursday night game against Judon and the Patriots. The Cowboys are on a pace for 71 sacks, a total that would be the most since the 1984 Chicago Bears set the record with 72. Dallas' pregame total of 4.2 is the most since the 1989 Vikings averaged 4.44 per game. That's what they do, O'Connell said. We tried to get the run game going early, and then we faced some third downs. Whether they were manageable or not, Kirk was under duress. And then, when you lose your left tackle early in the game, sometimes you can try to move that hard down around, and they just kept finding ways to affect Kirk. O'Connell said the Vikings tried to help protection on the outside, and the Cowboys caused problems on the interior. Sliding protection to help the interior only caused issues outside. We kind of took turns up front, O'Connell said. We took turns at different positions on our offense. Skill players included had just an uncharacteristically performance by our offense. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for November 21, 2022. I'm your reader, Craig Shives.